don't know if you know anything. In Pittsburgh. And I met J. David Davis also. I presume you're kind of associated with him too.
Mm-hmm.
I find him to be a phenomenal man.
Mm-hmm.
When I had the privilege of meeting him. And he spoke in our synagogue, I think, about 2 years ago. I felt like I was in the presence of Abraham.
Mm-hmm. He was here too.
Yeah. That's his odyssey, and in some very real sense, I'm sure those of you who are, if you consider yourselves to be Noah, then you've taken the same kind of path as he. And you deserve a lot of credit for it. And you're obviously going in the right direction, and God is guiding your path. Good luck to you. It isn't easy. I'm sure you have lots of strange emotional reactions from many, many family and members and friends and so on.
Strange is one word.
What I mean is, like, kind of unexpected. Are you familiar with Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a collection. In a very real sense, the Pirkei Avos is a guide to prophecy, indirectly. And most people don't know that. But in order to become a prophet, in order to become a Navi, which would be the highest level of relating to God, it's necessary to develop your soul to the maximum capability. There's the intellectual development, and then there's also the emotions that need to be channeled, harnessed, changed, modified. And Pirkei Avos is a guidebook on how to do that. It's practical ethics, practical philosophy, all combined together. When I say ethics, I'm using it in the broad term. It's like psychology as well. And as I've been studying this material over the years, I'm continually impressed by the breadth and scope of knowledge of our sages and how the human soul operates and how the soul works. Rabbi Moskowitz suggested I pick anything I want, and you'd be interested in anything, so here goes. This is from the first chapter in Ethics of the Fathers. It's Mishnah number 12, and it depends which edition. It's been such a popular section from the Talmud that it's been published in numerous editions, and sometimes the paragraphs, the Mishnayos, the section of study, is divided into different numbers. The text that I have ended at number 12. I'm not sure what the prayer book may have it as. So. All right, the basic text. See, I forgot to translate the basic text. Let me give that to you. Right, what usually happens in the Mishnah is the information is presented, and the Talmud will elaborate the details of logical possibilities in application, and it will also compare the material to other received sources that are similar to the Mishnah. That Talmud contains the Mishnah and then the Gemara, which explains the Mishnah. Pirkei Avos doesn't have that, but the commentaries that we do have, that I've been studying, Maimonides and Rashi, they provide the various details and present the information then in its application. And sometimes there's variation, and they're interesting. All right, here's a basic area that we're covering. Hillel, Shammai, Kibru Mehem. Hillel and Shammai received from them, this is the previous Mishnah, it was their teachers who were Shemaya and Daphtalia. So they received their study, their teachings from them. And Hillel, he's that famous one who told the story is told in the tractate Shabbos, teach me the whole Torah, to the prospective convert said to him, teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Right, the same Hillel. So Hillel says, Have mitalmidav shel Aharon, be of the students of Aaron, ohev shalom, love peace, virodev shalom, and chase after peace, ohevas habrios, love the creatures or creations or people. It usually means people, but it's different than the terminology of ish Anashim people, but Brios. So the implication is that which is created by God, Bria. Umakarvan la Torah, bring them close to Torah. Love peace, pursue peace, love the creatures or people, and bring them to Torah. That's the whole study. Right, so what are some of the problems that might need to be addressed here?
What does it mean to love peace and chase after peace? And what does it mean to love the creation?
I was giving you all the comments. It means love people.
Okay.
So it was a brios. Right. Some of the commentaries say that in terms of why the terminology of brios was used, that the essential reason for loving any other human being is not because you like them or they... How does love come about? Forgetting about your brios. I say that love comes about because there's an identification that happens unconsciously, an identification with another person, and they say the first 5 minutes or even less, the impressions are made, and how you're going to relate to that person is set up by those unconscious forces. So you don't know the person, but psychologically we intuit something, and we pick up that unconscious sense of the other person, and we just say, yeah, I like that person. That kind of love is based upon the childish stuff we've picked up from our parents that we need to overcome as adults. Ohevis abrios, love that which is created by God. Because brio implies is created
your
by God,
man.
Your fellow human being. Why should we love them? Because we're all created, b'tzelem Elohim, in the image of God, which I think is a much stronger statement than our constitution says. All men are created equal. We're not equal. We're all different. But we're all created by God, and we're all created in God's image. And therefore, because of our relationship to God, we should have this positive regard and love to all human beings. I think it's implied here. And I don't remember the source for that. I just remember hearing that years ago. All right, any other thoughts on the mission that people may have before we go into the...
What was the chase after? I've forgotten already.
Okay, love peace, chase after peace, love people, and bring them close to Torah.
How do you bring people close to Torah? Especially if people don't want to come close to Torah.
That's a good question.
I guess, too, I'd like to define what peace actually is.
That's a good point. Any ideas?
I know when you talk about an inner peace, it's when you feel quiet inside, I guess. That's coming from a feeling.
Well, how about the ability to live, to see reality clearly, and to get your emotions behind it, to
mesh with reality.
Yeah, mesh with reality.
Which produces the inner peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a freedom of the child. Frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi Moskowitz mentions, I think it was him, under the wedding canopy, he mentions someone that is a blur at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I have to check the video. But... I think it was Roman Moskowitz, about shalom being the absence of conflict. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's only one element of it. That may not necessarily be enough, but it's certainly a necessary first step. So you need to examine what's going on internally to remove the conflict. There's emotional conflicts that we need to, as you said, put the light of reason and knowledge on, so that
that's more than one step to remove.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why there's five chapters of Pirkei Avos.
Conflict could be momentary.
Yeah, there's many, many different emotional things that we all have. And each one of us has our own unique permutations of situations. But knowing the general principles is important, and I'm sure that if you've been studying with Robin Moskowitz, he's been focusing on that. Then the next stage is knowing yourself in a particular manner and applying the principles and working through the issues yourself. And then that's one of the reasons also why in the Torah system we can't be told the specifics, because it's so unique to each individual. In addition to that, each one of us has a different sequence and a different time frame, if you will, that we need to go through the various things that we have to do in terms of removing the conflict, in terms of working through the issues. I feel like I'm in slow motion. Not a hangover, just a little bit of a glow in the eyes.
Yeah. Well, I think peace is a road. And I think that peace probably can be a staple in our being or in our thought process just because we've found some truth. And we're on the way. To me, that would be peace. I mean, regardless of the facts that come along that I have to stumble through or have problems with, there's still some peace because I found, I could use a lot of terminology, but I found some truth, first off. I guess another terminology, how biblical is the way, we talked about Hakkar this morning, not my word. There are ways that we step into life. That would be peace to me, and that is my peace.
And finding the truth.
Finding some way to start out in life with truth.
Yeah, I made a similar point this Shabbos in my talk in Shul, that if you look at the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and it doesn't matter who you look at, they all had problems, the exact same issues that all human beings go through. You can start with Adam and Eve. They had the children, problems with raising the children. Cain and Abel was sibling rivalry. Abraham, first he and Sarah were married. They loved each other, obviously. They stayed with each other for many, many years. Couldn't have children. They worked that through. Then finally they worked out a way of having a child through Hagar. And so there was conflict there. Right, it's true, it's a different social environment than we're accustomed to, but still, they were accustomed to, but it presented problems, friction in the household. And finally, Sarah does have a child, and Yishmael, he gets jealous, it seems, of Isaac, and he's teasing him in some kind of cruel manner. And Sarah says, you know, he can't stay, he's got to leave, that bothers Abraham tremendously. We see the verse tells us that it bothered him because of sending away his son. He couldn't deal with that. It was a terrible shock to him. and finally they do grow up, but then he had, look at all the children he had. Isaac was the only one who carried on the teachings. And the others, he sent them away. He realized that they had to separate. Of course that would be a disappointment to him. Isaac, he didn't have it so easy either. He had a conflict with the Plishtim, the people who were around him. He was trying to continue with his father's program and with the wells and the attack, and he was constantly in a situation of conflict with the peoples around him until finally the people recognized him. It was a long struggle though. His children, Esau and Yaakov, also, you know, he didn't have children right away, so that was a difficulty in the marriage and in the relationship, and then in terms of they had betrayed to God. Then the two children, Esau and Yaakov, they had their conflicts. Esau turned into a gangster, into a person who didn't follow the Torah teachings properly, and he fooled his father, and finally his father figured it out, and Esau then threatens to kill his brother Jacob. Rivka says, you gotta run away, go to my uncle's band. And it's on and on and on. You know, you name the person, they all had the problem. So the Torah doesn't guarantee we're not going to have human relation problems or financial problems, and all of those things will occur. But, as you said, with the Torah, with the system of truth that God has given us, that will provide us with solutions. And that's where I think the tranquility can come about. We know we're going to have it. A person is created for all kinds of hard struggle. That's part of life. But having an approach, having an ability, and knowing that there is a way of dealing with situations, that I think is, you know, a certain sense of tranquility. And that's what made them tzaddikim, that they had the methodology and they applied the methodology. Right? So there's conflict, there's inner conflict, there's also external conflict. I think if we look at conflict, there's two types. There's the inner and the outer conflict. And the outer conflict needs to be dealt with, but the inner conflict is probably more important to work out. As I look around our society, I see people struggling tremendously to deal with the external conflict and failing to recognize that many times a reflection of the inner turmoil that people have. And I can play with the external world as much as I want, and if I don't take care of what's going on inside, then I still won't be satisfied with what happens externally. That's the whole issue of how people are trying to find peace, trying to remove the conflict. Yes.
I have personal experience that I don't really see or learn too much when I study, when I do Torah, which is, you hear what they're saying. I have discovered that my internal life actually in some way brings about my external life. But we don't talk about that. I mean, we talk about them as so separate. I find personally that they're like one. My external life is the result to me of my internal life. I don't mean minute by minute, but generally. So we don't talk about that. It's almost like, what, mystical?
Well, I don't know what you mean by mystical, but what you're saying makes sense to me. We are attempting to relate and understand and perceive reality. And so what we do, if I can use a metaphor, is we make a map of that reality. And we're interacting with our map. Our map tells us where to go, and I think that's what you're saying. At the same time, the map is where we are. I think there's an allusion to that idea in Genesis, in the discussion of God presenting Adam with the task of naming the animals and the creation of Eve. And so to recall, actually, the end of verse 19 in Genesis chapter 2, verse 19, right, all of the animals were brought by God to Adam to categorize them, to understand, to get some concept as to what they are. And all that Adam called each nefesh chaya, each living creature, ushmo, that is its name. And the idea of giving names is means the idea of understanding the essence of the creature. It was for the task of trying to understand and differentiate between himself and a relationship with another human being and the relationships that animals have with their mates. But the concept here is that, one, human beings can have a perception, and the perception that we have does mesh with reality. There is a correlation. But I also understand from this that our name, so that the name that we give things, that's what we deal with. That's how we deal with it. So if I have a distortion in how I name things and how I understand things, then I will have conflict with the world around me. That'll be that's where some of the source of the conflict comes from. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you're saying, too. So if the inner world is closer to truth, and recognizing as human beings, we're not going to get, we can't get the whole picture. It's not possible. But thank God, he's given us the capability of perceiving something. And it's amazing. We see a little bit, and that little bit is truth. It is truth. It isn't the whole picture, but that's because we can't see what God sees, so to speak. And we don't have God's perception, but He's given us the capability to a certain extent of having a certain tzelem Elokim. We have a certain reflection of the image of God. That's our wisdom, our capability of seeing knowledge. And that helps us. And that's, I think, big. So why don't we take a look at some of the commentaries and see how they approach it. Let's take a look at Rashi. Now, I will translate Rashi directly, and we can make corrections on it if you would like to. Kind of a draft. I might need some work. Rashi says, first he points out that Hillel and Shammai Kivu Mehem, they received their tradition from Mishmaya and Altalia, from their teachers Shemaya and Altalia.
Previous then to Hillel and Shammai.
That's correct. Okay. So that's another one of the things. Indirectly, we can derive the chain of the transmission. The first chapter gives us the rabbis who were the heads of the Sanhedrin.
Can you go on ahead now of this and quote names, or do we stop here with Hillel and Shammai?
No, there's more. There's more after that.
We were just sort of into this before you came this morning a little bit.
Mm-hmm. After that, you have Simon, okay. Shimon ben Gamliel. There's others.
Okay.
Yeah, Maimonides in his introduction to his Mishneh Torah, he has 40 generations from Moses to the close of the Talmud. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there might be there are some variations. You know, you've got a long span of time. But there's pretty much agreement, and we can go back to 40 generations.
Are these the gentlemen you alluded to at the beginning when you said you kept seeing more of the wisdom of their teachers?
Well, them too, but you know, I'm talking about the commentaries, the one we're going to get into now.
Okay.
Yeah, Rashi,
okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're the masters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Hillel and Shammai, they were what's known as the Baalei HaKabbalah, the masters of the tradition. They were the ones who were selected by their peers to be the head of the Sanhedrin, and consequently they were the ones who were charged with establishing when there would be any issues of what the content of Torah, the oral Torah, should be. They were equally as responsible in transmitting things accurately as well. It's a marvelous system of checks and balances, because what happened was you take, it's like the best doctors selecting the expert based on their expertise. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we have. The doctors of halacha, the masters of implementing the system of Torah for human perfection, and they were the ones who selected the most qualified individuals from the group. All right, so Rashi then focuses on Hazemi Talmido Shal Aharon, be the students of Aaron. Klomar, that's to say, Heve Lamad Me Aharon, learn from Aaron. Shehoya Ohev Shalom, for he was a lover of peace. Now you notice that in the Hebrew, it's present tense. It's Ohev, a lover, and it's one who is loving. You know, so the implication is that it's like a continuous process. Something that he was focusing on in stimulating himself into that approach and following the path. And it's just, the same is true in all of these. Ohev, lover of peace, rodev, one who pursues in the present tense or future, even possibly in the Hebrew, or and a lover, one who is in a state of loving people. So he quotes the text from the prophet Malachi, chapter 2, verse 5. Barisi ha'isa'ito, my covenant was with him, achayim v'hasholom, covenant of life and of peace. Right? And then he explains, kishahayo ro'esh na'im merivim, when Aaron might see two people who were arguing ze im ze, one with the other, ha'yaholech l'chol echad v'echad, he would go to each one, Shalomidas Chavero, without the knowledge of the associate, of the other friend. Omalo, and he would say to him, Ploni is a Hebrew term for Mr. Anonymous, Mr. So-and-so. Ray, look, Lama Atom Meridim Ploni, why are you in a conflict? Why are you fighting with the other person? Halohu Nishtateach Lefonai Ufaiseini Lovo Etzlechoch. Don't you know that that's not in the text, but it's in English. We met one another, we bumped into one another, and he's pleaded with me to placate you, to love away etzlacha, to go to you, v'daverimcha, to speak with you, im asha disrasalis payasima, you want to make up with him, implying that he's embarrassed to approach you directly, so he sent me to go between, hoping that I could sway you to go back and have another relationship again. Similarly, he would go to his associate. This kind of a conversation, these words, he would then produce peace between the two of them. Story number one. Now we have another story. Amar echad le'ishto, a person says to his wife, Konein she'ein ne'anes li. That's a technical legal term. I didn't really know how to translate it. It's just an English kind of thing. But I set up a situation that I may not, it should be I. The husband says to his wife that I will not have any benefit from you. Okay? Which means you can't have marital relations, and effectively then he's put his wife into an untenable marriage situation. Alright, I can't get any benefits from you anymore. You can't until you spit in the eye of the high priest. That's Aaron is the high priest. Aaron Shomea, Aaron heard this. He would go to this woman. And he would say, Plonika, Mrs. So and so. Chashti b'enai. I have some kind of an AI ailment. Varok shaloch rafua yeshvo. And your saliva has healing qualities to it. Right? Tarok liba ayin, do me a favor, spit in my eye. Right? And she would spit in his eye. The al came, and therefore it says about Aaron when he died in Numbers chapter 20:29, the whole household of Israel cried when Aaron died. Right? Echad anoshim v'echad nashim. This identical involvement of weeping was both the men and the women, right? Meaning that they all did. It's because it's just kol, the whole. B'mashma, that's what apparently the verse implies. U'v'moshe lo ne'mar, by Moses, this was not what was said when he died. Elo b'nei Yisrael, right? It only says the people of Israel. As the text says in Deuteronomy, v'yivku b'nei Yisrael, and the people of Israel cried for Moshe when he died. There was a different reaction. With Moses, apparently not everybody cried to the same degree as they did with Aaron. That's a separate question too, why that's the case. But there's enough material here to keep us going for a couple of weeks. Yeah?
Can we presume that Rashi put that last sentence in as a contrast?
It's a contrast
to Aaron. In other words, everybody cried when Aaron died, but he's saying that a more limited group cried for Moses.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we assuming then that since we're studying this idea of peace, that Aaron was he definitely lived his life to make peace between people at peace?
Yeah, we definitely see that. Yeah, he went out of his way. What are the stories? And, you know, that's These stories are presented to teach us, and the question is, what are they teaching us? We see that he didn't just get up on a pulpit and preach, but he went out to the people, and the most obvious thing is that he did what it took to get people back together again.
So remember the story of Moses when he was younger, and he did kill somebody. He didn't try to move that situation.
Well, are you implying something with that?
No, just the fact that it would be less likely to call. To me, Moses was a leader of the people, following God's word, and Aaron was the spiritual leader. There's a difference. I see a difference between the two leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And that the spiritual leader, he actually practiced the thing with the Peter. Here's examples. And now I'm assuming these are true. Are they just meant as analogies to understand Aaron, or did these actually took place?
Well, the basic rule of thumb that I operate by is that if it's within the range of normal human possibilities, unless we're told specifically there's a miracle, but if it's within the range of normal human activity, then I just take it as having occurred, but then they're not telling us the story as a biographical footnote, mm-hmm. but for the purposes of teaching us something. And there's an interesting question also about the book of Job. Is it a parable or not? And Elijah of Vilna, 17th century Torah scholar, who's called the Vilna Gaon, he says it in Hebrew, but it translates in English. In Hebrew, he said, "Iyov lo hayov lo nivra ella lamashal." Iyov never was, nor did he exist, except to be a parable. Notice the beautiful ambiguity there. In other words, he said, I don't know, maybe he did live and he was a historical figure, maybe he didn't. But in either case, his life is presented to us in order for us to learn from what happened.
To example
his many, many teachings and through his experience. So that's what's happening here. We're being presented. Did it happen? Don't know. Could it have? Absolutely. This is the type of person that Aaron would have been. All right, so we seem to focus on the last part first, I'll give you a short explanation of that. Moses and Aaron, what is the difference between their two respective relationships? I believe that, and I may have heard this, a basic idea from Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'm not sure. If it's good, I heard it from, if you don't like it, it's mine, that's fine. Moses was the Melech, the king. So that was his role. He was the spiritual leader, but he functioned as the melech, as the king, and also as an authority. Right? As the authority, he stated what was right, what was wrong. Aaron, on the other hand, was a teacher and implementer of the system that was taught by Moshe. As a teacher, Moshe was also a teacher, but of a different type of teacher. He had to present the truth and present all of what was occurring. Aaron took the teachings and applied them on a day-to-day basis. I'd say it's similar, and this is my idea, I just thought of the analogy. It's similar, I think, the relationship of a mother and father. The father presents, and both parents really have to incorporate both of these qualities, but essentially the father presents a position of teaching to the children, and the children have to earn the love of the father by performing according to the standards that are presented by the father. On the other hand, the mother's love is unconditional.
I heard that yesterday on TV program.
The mother accepts the child, mm-hmm. dirty, clean, unconditionally. It's because there's a closer physiological, psychological relationship. I mean, that's just the way it starts. Right? So that certain sense of security is essential, and that's what occurs there. Now, of course, the mother has to teach the child, but the mother teaches the child from that perspective. The father wants the child to come up to standards. The mother gives the approval. The mother gives the approval all the time, but still encourages to the standards. obviously fathers have to have both of those qualities, and mothers need both of those qualities.
So you mean that fathers represent Moshe and mothers represent Aaron?
Well, no, I'm saying that Moshe operated as the father, presenting the standards.
Right.
And then if you follow the standards, now you can have his approval. And by the same token, if you don't follow his standards, you have his disapproval. Whereas with Aaron, he was there in the field, so to speak, presenting and trying to show how to apply the standards. So he wasn't the one who gave us the standards, but he was following the standards like everybody else. And so he was helping everybody. He was implementing the system so he could do it in a more soft way. You have to have the truth presented without sugarcoating. Once you have that, now you can have someone else who can do the sugarcoating to bring us up to the standard, mm-hmm. who can bring us to mm-hmm. that level. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who can come down to my level and make it palatable to me so that I can then see and go to the real truth. Because you see what Aaron is doing in each situation, he's lying in a sense. Mm-hmm. What he's doing is he's going down to that person's level and presenting the truth to them so that they can see it and then incorporate it. As he says, do you have a question?
I have a
question. Just want to be sure that's all.
I was thinking in the comparison between David and Solomon and the temple. Solomon was gone and not committed from the temple, but he was a warrior type of leader. But on the other hand, Solomon. Of course, Solomon had his problems too, but he was given the authority to build the temple.
Uh-huh.
Whether he would like to dislike it, I know it's a little far-fetched in a sense, but I was just thinking of the comparison between where Moses was the leader. Sometimes leaders don't always settle on their people. They don't like to be told too much.
So we see that was the case with the people of Israel over and over again. They had this reaction to being told various things. The story of the golden calf. When Moses went up onto Mount Sinai, he was delayed in coming back, and I believe Rashi mentions that Satan came. There were all kinds of phenomena going on. Cloudy, the weather was all mixed up and confused. And Rashi, I believe, quotes a midrash that says that Satan showed them something that looked like a funeral bier of Moses, and so therefore they thought Moses died. So what's going on there? So apparently there was a witch who apparently wanted him to be gone. Again, if you don't have enough information one way or the other, so how do you know what's occurring? So here you see some kind of stuff up there. They interpreted then the whole situation. Oh, Moses must have died. And so, in a certain sense, then, there was an ambivalence on the part of the people to Moses and the leader. Because, why? And do all of you have experience with children? And think about your own childhood. What happens when someone says to you, no? Your response, what do you mean, no? Now you're in a state of frustration. You don't like the person who's giving you that pain now. And when you tell little children no, what's sometimes their response? I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's part of the ambivalence. They really do hate us when we say no. They'll get over it, but that's where some of that ambivalence is. Moses was that authority who said, no, this you can't do, this you can, this is what you must do, this is what's necessary to be done. Aaron wasn't in that position. How much time are we allotted?
As much as you want. I mean, we're technically scheduled till about 3, but we have nothing scheduled after that, so we can do 2:45, I think.
I was told only till about 2.
Oh.
Well, forget it.
We're at your disposal, then.
I
may
need to be somewhere else, too. But
okay.
I prefer trying to work things through and allow you to play with the ideas. Mm-hmm. But at least to give you some closure also. You have two stories that are presented by Rashi. right? Two parables. And some questions. Are you the ones who've been working with Rabbi Moskowitz on the methodology of Proverbs?
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a question. The first story, for example, where he goes to one and says one thing and does the other and kind of gets them back together,
mm-hmm.
you could extrapolate that to say, well, you ought to basically, whenever there's a conflict with someone else, sort of roll over and play dead in order to establish peace. So mm-hmm. if someone is coming to you and making some demand that maybe you don't think is appropriate, you could say, well, okay, whatever you want, because I just want to have peace. It doesn't strike me that that's quite necessarily the appropriate thing to do. How do you take this concept and apply it to the everyday conflicts?
Yeah, the second story. Where he spit in the eye.
Well, either one, actually. I mean,
well, the first. Well. Okay. Yeah. What is the source of any conflict?
Ego. What?
Work with Rabbi Moskowitz.
Didn't hear you.
That's right. Ego.
Ego.
Oh, ego.
Ego.
We don't get what we want.
We don't get what we want.
Yeah, a cutesy little, it illustrates the point, but I heard a rabbi give a wedding speech. The marriage, what you want to be, is united. But it all depends where the little I is. If it's after the T, then it's untied. That's all where the little I is. The ego. And in any conflict, of course, my worldview, of course, is correct.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you're talking about. Obviously, I'm right. And I think that, of course, it makes sense to me. And of course, my frame of reference is correct. And the other person's an idiot and stupid. They don't know what they're talking about. So, but any argument, any emotionally based argument, really partakes of that same kind of lunacy, if you will, that ego. And the reason that people maintain the fight and get locked into the conflict situation is they can't accept the possibility. Now, wait a minute. We've got a conflict here. I've got my frame of reference. He's got his frame of reference. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the other person is right. Maybe we're both wrong. Right? That's a possibility too. But maybe he's right, and I should be changing my view of the situation. I have to entertain that. Right? These people are stuck in there, and they're not changing their view. So, while the situations, I think, may be to the extreme, Aaron isn't involved in the relationships, is he?
Mm-hmm.
What Aaron is doing is intervening and doing something to get the people back into some kind of a harmonious relationship.
He's obviously a great psychologist and understands what's creating each of them.
Yeah, in the second story, the guy sets up an obviously, from his frame of reference, an obviously impossible situation for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He says, sure, I'll get back together with you when you go spit in the eye of the high priest. Ha, 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 ha. So, no way you're going to be able to do that, dear. Lo and behold, it's done. It's done.
Instead of wanting to set up another situation that would... if he's of the mind to act in that manner, then I would certainly think that another situation would
come up. That's right. Now, what is the purpose of the story? I said, that's a very good question there. Is the purpose of the story here to teach us how to intervene? Or is the purpose of the story to teach us something about Aaron?
I think it teaches us about Aaron.
So if we look at it from the framework of Aaron, both of these stories are about Aaron. So what was Aaron willing to do? What is Aaron willing to do in order to help people.
Should we ask how we help ourselves? Without an intermediary? Without a real problem?
Well, what we need to do, if we have problems, then we go to an appropriate therapist, a chacham.
That
would be our solution, yeah.
It's not what you think that produces... I'm sorry, it's not what happens... Boy, am I spacey. It's not what happens... Yeah, it's not what happens to you that produces emotional responses, but rather it's your view of the situation. And I'm sure you've heard him say that frequently. That's the basics of cognitive therapy. So now you see there's a situation that occurs, and there's an emotional response. One of the examples I use very frequently is an experience that happened to me. And as a rabbi, I have occasions to be on a cemetery. If you know, an unveiling where we have a prayer service for someone who's passed away, family gets together, and obviously with that kind of a situation, I want to be dressed appropriately. It was a hot summer, so I was wearing a light suit, and I had injured my leg that summer, and I could not wear normal shoes. And now I'm wearing these black jogging shoes, and unless you see that and look close, you won't necessarily know that they're a different kind of shoe. Those days, there were no black shoes. They were fluorescent blue, fluorescent red, I don't remember, whatever, but it was very, very bright. Those are the only kind of shoes I could wear. See, and plus I was walking with a cane at that point. I had progressed. I was walking with a cane at that point now. So here I am, at a very important, significant life cycle event. There's a past president of my synagogue, someone that I was very friendly with, I had a good relationship with. We used to study weekly as well. I'm certainly not going to do anything to insult anyone. Lo and behold, a son-in-law comes and he sees those shoes from a distance, and I could hear him like 3 blocks away. It was a long cemetery. The guy, as red as your blouses, that's how livid he got in terms of anger. Oh, and he was furious. The rabbi, he could be.
How dare you?
How dare he? Right. As he gets closer, he noticed the cane, and you see his face softens, and now all of a sudden he's filled with sympathy.
Yeah.
What happened? So what happened? The shoes made him angry, and the cane calmed him down. That's the way people tend to think. But what really happened is that there was a belief about what the significance of the shoes were. Yeah, if he's wearing shoes like that, that means he's showing major disrespect. And then there's, of course, why is he doing this to me or to my father-in-law? I can't stand him doing that. That's terrible and awful. This is the basic element.
How he's dressed.
Yeah. So looking at the beliefs will take, if they're in line with reality, if they're rational, then the emotional response will be appropriate. Right? Negative emotional responses are appropriate as well. You know, I've lost $100 in a business investment. You know, if I don't have that much money, $100 is a lot, I'm disappointed. Right? Now, if I get depressed over $100, that's an inappropriate, that's an exaggerated response because of I have certain ideas about that. It's terrible and awful, and I can't stand losing the money, which exaggerates the reality. All right, there's a difference between healthy grief and a serious depression. Healthy grief would be, I lost someone who's close to me, I lost a loved one, and I'm sad. I'm disappointed they couldn't participate with me in this event or that event, or there may be some future life cycle events that they won't be with me about. That's normal, that's appropriate, and that's what you want. On the other hand, when people say, I can't go on living without so-and-so, sometimes that occurs just temporarily because it's such a strong emotional reaction. But if it lasts for a longer period of time, then it's called a depression. And you'll find that low self-esteem is there. You know, this person died and I'm worthless now without, wives. God forbid, lose their husbands. They say, I'm nobody now without without my spouse. And vice versa, that can happen. I've got children, a child dies. You can think of all the examples, but it's where the self-esteem is tied in with the loss as well. That's an exaggerated response based on an irrational belief that exaggerates the reality and a variety of different permutations there. So bringing it down to reality will remove the excess exaggerated response, or by the same token, the inappropriate, inadequate emotional response. Right? It's that, I think it's that middle of the road of my mind. There's an appropriate response. There's no, every idea has a certain has an emotion associated with it, and every emotion has ideas associated with it. It's not in a vacuum. Now, we categorize them conceptually, but in reality, they're always associated one with the other. So, loving peace, I mean, it means, it's not going to take away from God. All right, in order to get to God, we need to be harmonious. We have to be in a situation which is harmonious. In order to get to God, therefore, I have to be committed to not only my own state of harmony, but to other people as well. It's beneficial to me, it's beneficial to God's society. If I love God, as Maimonides presents it, our love for all of humanity is based upon our relationship to God. So, if I love God, then I'm going to love whatever God loves. God wants humanity, the world, to be harmonious.
I don't disagree with that. That's a natural outcome. The other way of saying to love peace sounded to me like it's a law.
Yeah, but how do so I'm not at the point where I have that kind of comprehension yet of God. So I still need to implement this. I can implement this. And that will bring me back to a higher level so that I can be more in a more closer relationship with God. Yes?
Would that be the Ohet Es Habriyat U Mekar Zayin B'Torah, get close to the Torah, and to learn all this here? Shalom B'Habriyat, that's what that means?
I think yes, these are the things that God has created and given us the program, the instruction manual, if you will, of how to live life and how to... So by enabling other people to get this knowledge and this truth, you're showing them the greatest love. You're giving them the methodology of how to achieve the peace as well.
Rabbi Moskowitz is the stuff. Yeah. We learned from the open.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. So the stories. Let's go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, okay, the stories are about ways that Aaron sort of implemented loving peace.
Mm-hmm.
We're told by Rashi, well, and by the Pirkei Avos itself, mm-hmm. via the students of Aaron, which would lead me to believe they're saying emulate Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question comes, well, to what degree and how?
Mm-hmm. What did Aaron do? In the first story, Aaron saw two people, and they were in a fight. And what did he do? He jumped in and he solved the conflict. He removed the conflict between two people.
How?
Well, that's another question.
Oh, that's another question.
Yeah, there are a lot of different levels at which we can approach this.
So
I just want to give a basic approach. So essentially, Aaron jumped in and stopped the fight.
He didn't let them fight it out.
That's right. He didn't. Okay. What happened? So why? You know, did you ever notice when there's a fight, what do people do?
Gather around and watch.
Mm-hmm. They what?
They gather around and watch. They watch.
Yeah. Oh, you
why
watch.
They
yeah.
watch.
Yeah.
Why are they watching? What's going on?
Why do they watch?
See the outcome.
Sort of gruesome gruesome curiosity.
I'm thinking of people going by car accidents. They always slow down by car.
Well, look what happened with O.J. Simpson's watching in L.A. There's something within ourselves.
Yeah, I don't really know what happened there. I just keep hearing little bits and pieces. So I don't know what happened. Yeah.
So what is it about us that we have this sense to watch a fight, to glorify it somehow?
We have a tendency to think we are identifying.
The people standing around watching other people fight are identifying in some way with the fighters.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me.
If you've had children, I know I've experienced it. If my son was in a fight, You know, I'd stop it, but if he was winning, I'd stop it a little slower. If he was losing, a little quicker. that kind of that's the identification.
Yeah.
You identify with the winner. It gives us a chance to maybe get out some of our hostility.
Yeah, it's part of our own hostility.
So there's an identification there. And an enjoyment of the fight. You know, here we can...
That's what I get out of sports. The same
that's sports.
Identify
right.
And get enjoyed.
Let them fight it out. And it's not my business. Why should I? Because there's also a break in identification. There's a denial. A certain kind of denial. That's not my business. I don't want to get involved.
And yet there's...
So there's a perverse identification and then denial. Denial that you're really... you justify it by getting involved as it's not my business. You know, let them fight it out by themselves. So there's identification and you break the identification.
Yeah, because there's a sense of responsibility.
That's Aaron.
Aaron didn't do that.
He jumped in and said, listen, this is not good. I have to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Right? So the question is, why do you have a second story? So we see he was so involved in pursuing peace that he got involved and did what it took to get the people to make peace amongst themselves. So why tell... So one story would have been enough. We don't need two stories. What's the second story? What do you need the second story for? I mean, you had indicated that it was like... It was exaggerated. He did weird things, right?
Yeah, I just thought that... I mean, it was rather pointless considering...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you go in, the first story looks totally different to me than the second. The first story, you know, he's going after these people individually to
mm-hmm.
begin with. There's one difference of the stories.
Right.
And he's dealing with them on a level of, you know, he's identifying, okay, I know that their egos are such that neither one wants to take blame or
mm-hmm.
or take a hand at peace. And so he goes in. But it seems like there's a viable solution there, you know, he could
mm-hmm.
actually attain something.
Right.
Whereas in the second one, sure, maybe he could stop this one instance, but what good
that's
is
true.
It because
that's
you're...
True. I think you're right. But I think from the perspective, though, of Aaron, we learned something different.
Yeah, is the perspective of Aaron that he didn't do the act in the second story with the idea that he was going to solve all the marriage problems, but more as... Getting back to the issue of Moses is the authority, Aaron is the implementer, as an example of acts one should do in order to make peace occur.
What kind of acts?
Direct. One is indirect and one is direct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the first one, he wasn't really an active participant.
Okay.
And in the second one, he is.
He's about as involved as you can get.
Yeah.
In what way is he involved?
Well, he's the one that the act would be done to.
All right. So what kind
of
an act is
it?
How is he victimized here? What happens to him? All right. So what kind of person gets spit on?
A weak one, I guess.
A weak person.
A vulnerable one.
Lowly, humble.
Realistic. I think he knows his spit isn't going to do him any harm. Pretty realistic.
Yeah, what, would you let someone spit on you as their therapy? What does it take for Aaron then to put himself in that? Now, who is Aaron?
The high priest.
Second in command to?
Mm-hmm.
Moshe.
Yeah.
Well, what could have Aaron said here? What you're saying? This guy is crazy.
Well, you know, not a judgment call, but rather
yeah,
just
the guy is not
be realistic.
Yeah,
what
realistic,
is it
going to
do? Let
right,
this
I'm,
woman spit on me, you know.
So therefore, it's just an illustration of the nature of Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
That Aaron, see, what would happen? What will happen? You've been in a situation where people get into a fight, and you jump in and try to stop the fight. What kind of reaction might you get?
They get mad at you.
Yeah.
Why?
You can't get.
Why?
Mind your own business.
That's right.
Yeah.
So who are you to butt in?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're trying to lord it over us? What do you think? You're the boss or something? Who made you God all of a sudden? So Aaron, he's the leader. He is the leader. So perhaps, see, that's why the first story isn't enough. Perhaps Aaron is doing this. You know, he's in a position of authority and he's exercising his authority. He's in charge, so he wants to have his flock act accordingly, and he's going to do what it takes.
So he steps in.
So he steps in and exercises mm-hmm. his authority.
Well, and the husband, I have to stop and think about what the husband is thinking about now. I mean, he's just put something to his wife that's impossible.
Right.
And the number two guy, in God's mind, this guy's view is now saying, hey, what you did, I know what you did, and I thwarted it.
That's right.
You know.
So it's a good intervention. But it
he
also
humbled
shows...
Himself tremendously.
That's right,
humbled the husband.
Humbled, that's right.
Big
that's,
time.
See, that even if you're going to put that kind of a situation upon your wife, Aaron the high priest said, I'm willing to go along with it, because I'm sure you know that's a childish thing.
mm-hmm.
But it will be seen about the nature of Aaron that he wasn't looking to lord it over people, that his motivation was for Shalom, for true harmony. He was reality-based, he didn't have the ego, he wasn't in the position of leadership for his own gratification, for his own needs, but rather he was primarily interested in the needs of other people. That's an Ohev Shalom in other people. Ohev of other people of Brios. He went into their frame of reference. Look, this is what they need. So then whatever it takes, I will do. It doesn't matter. So I can spit on. Right? I don't know that I could do.
There's a sense that this husband is just not going to be able to be the same man
after this
happens. It's impossible for him not to have some second thoughts that if Aaron did this and he's aware of what he did, he's going to have second thoughts. I don't know what he'll do about it.
Yeah, what else can he
have second thoughts? He's got to reconsider his own attitude.
Talk to a therapist with paradoxical interventions. That would be... I've thought about it, but it might be interesting to think of the kind of possibilities there would be.
I would say that Aaron did it for Shalom Bayit.
Yes, he did.
Peace of the home.
Yeah. But it shows us what his motivation was. That his motivation was not... It also shows us what his motivation was not. It's showing us that his motivation was not for personal aggrandizement. It was not for satisfaction of his own ego. It was not because he was in a leadership position and it wasn't the big I. It was the needs of everyone else in this day in consideration.
Great guy.
Can we go beyond that when we're talking about how it will affect our lives? Another lesson for us.
So this is what we're strive for. It's now.
But this is butting into other people's business. This isn't helping my ego.
Well, see, now there's two things here that you're raising. The question is, when should I be making an intervention? That's a judgment call as well, that we need to know the people to whom we're speaking and make the judgment, will they listen to us or will it just cause some kind of a negative reaction? I think that in that sense, Aaron had the position, and so therefore he used his position appropriately. We may not be in the position, so we have to make that as a judgment.
Well, sometimes I find myself when I'm trying to decide whether to do that or not, whether to interview or not, sometimes I'll say to myself, well, you're not going to have any effect. And it may be realistic or may not be realistic, or it may just be a reflection of, I'm afraid to be told, butt out.
That's good.
You know.
I had many, many years ago before professional, I had the experience of doing just that, telling two people that were related that for years they'd been not speaking. And I called one up and said the other one wants to make up, and I did the other and said they did. They finally made up, and one of them still doesn't speak to me. Many years have passed. In other words, her anger
lied
butting in, even though it worked, but nevertheless, she's never gotten over the anger of my butting in.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it bother you? Does it bother you?
Does it bother you?
Sure. I'm sure sad about that. I feel sad when I see her and she looks the other way and doesn't talk to me. I feel sad, sure.
See, but that's not the same as why is she doing this to me?
No.
That's the difference.
No,
that's
I don't
a
think
realistic.
It personally. I understand.
That's right, that's a realistic. So Aaron also, he's not taking it personally. Mm-hmm. He's dealing with the reality of the situation. Because if he took it personally, there's no way he could let her spit in
the
my eye. Mm-hmm. What's everybody else going to say? What are people going to say about Aaron? Mm-hmm. High priest?
He can spit him in the eye.
it's not kavod, that's not proper honor to give to give like a king, high priest, leader.
Couldn't you at that time get the death penalty or something like that in those times?
Sure. Certainly with an absolute monarch.
I know you have to go. Do you have time for a question?
We'll see how long you can answer.
Okay. is there a way to extrapolate from this when you yourself are involved in the conflict? at what point to sort of give away things in order to make a peaceable settlement versus and carry it to the case of a legal case where someone is pressing you about something and you feel like you have a justified case why their position is inappropriate, but you could sort of roll over and play dead in order to make the whole thing disappear and go away. I realize it's a broad question.
Yeah, that's too general. But again, there's going to be a judgment call. Depends. I would say that if it's in the area of emotional things, then you know that those are the areas to where the maximum compromises should occur.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, by way of example, like when you have the wedding plans and things like that, it's amazing how many weddings I've seen where all the family issues, they hit the fan, and you have different honors to give or different recognitions to make, and it really gets
enemies, new enemies,
new alignments, and so on and so forth. It's great. This wedding, we had absolutely none of that.
Oh, you were dealing with great people.
Well,
somebody must have done something right.
Well, we both, Sarah and I discussed it, and we said, look, we'll do what we can, and apparently the employees keep doing the same. I don't know. It was great. It was easy. Mm-hmm. Last minute changes. Fine. This way, that way. Whatever the kids want, and whatever. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Your wife's name is Sarah too.
Yeah.
Oh, when you said Sarah, I didn't know which is Sarah. Mm-hmm. Who you talking about? Because I know Sarah, your daughter-in-law.
So in those areas, more likely than not, when it's going to be an emotional area, then I would say that if we have to look at ourselves and recognize, what the conflict then is, a feedback mechanism that's giving us information. What might I be doing? That's always a good thing to check. What might I be doing to contribute to the situation? Am I doing something? I may not be. It may strictly be the other person. And then, if it is the other person, I may not be able to do anything about it. I mean, the other person may just be crazy. The other person may have some irrational beliefs that I can't really change. So then the question is, do I want to maintain the relationship with that person or not? If I want to, then I'm going to have to let them spit in my eye, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the nature of human relations. I have idiosyncrasies, you have idiosyncrasies. We want to work together, then I'm going to accommodate some of your idiosyncrasies. As long as they're not to the extent that I can't work with you, then it's okay. And that's part of human existence. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you mentioned if there's a law, a legal thing, it depends what it is. If I feel that there's some justification onto my part, check it out, and it's worthwhile to pursue, then I would pursue it. And if not, I just let it go. I had a situation with a New York landlord. I learned something out of it. We're talking the deposit. I don't remember how much the deposit was. But he took me through the apartment afterwards, and there were certain things in the apartment that I was supposed to take and pay for that had been there. He said I could. And he said, let me have the key. He says, well, let me get the things out. Oh, I'll let you get back in. Let me have the key. So he had the key. I gave him the key. And then he didn't let me back in the apartment to get those other things, which the deposit was going to cover. And then he says, well, the window was broken, and this, that, and the other. And the window was broken when we moved in. Don't you remember? We were trying to get you to fix the window all along. And this was, and he made up all of these. And then the carpet you put a carpet down. Yeah, but that added value to your to you, we got your permission in advance. Well, that whatever it was, I got very upset with that, and I just walked away from him. And I told him, I hate to put this on tape. Please, yeah.
You told me the time is a factor that has to be considered. It's a new time we all have all this.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a difference as to how it's all going to work out. Time as a factor.
Yeah. One of the things that I have found is the more involved I become in this approach, then the quicker I can make more accurate the judgments. You know, it's like any skill. The more practice you have and rehearsal in advance, then when you need the skill, then you're more fluid, and capable. And the concert pianist or violinist that gets up, you know, they play so effortlessly and so spontaneously after all of those years and years of practice. We need to tune our the instruments of our minds. One of the questions I ask frequently to people when I'm talking to a quote more educated group, one time I got a real show of hands, but generally not. I ask, how many of you here are required through their college education or someone required to take a course in logic? And it seems to be one of the most important tools that we use, our minds, and yet we're not shown or taught how to use it. And psychology, you know, the nature of the soul, how does it work, how do emotions work, how can they help me, how can they hinder me, what can I do to harmonize my soul, how do I do it? No courses. In the Torah system, there's courses.
Why is that, really?
Why?
Why is our education system, when you get out of the system, people speak always of these important subjects that aren't available,
they don't know how. The Torah system, we're fortunate that God has given us the system and has shown us that it works. And if you look at the history of the Jewish people, and we see the continuous, consistent production of kinds of Torah scholars that have always been developed, and there's always this harmony. You know, the leaders, the Talmidei Chachamim that we look to, it's never just simple scholarship. They don't have PhDs and then live their lives like crazy people. And the people who are mathematicians, scientists, in that one area of knowledge, they have knowledge, but then it goes to the rest of their lives. It's all mixed up like everybody else. That's not the case within the Torah. It's the Torah system. That's what produces it. That's what produces it consistently and continuously.
Holistic man.
That's it. The Torah system is a holistic, holistic system. And you can spell holy any way you want.
This presents a big problem in that secular higher education has nothing for the person in this area.
Right. Doesn't teach people but how to
live.
But
neither does the Jewish community have open doors.
I can't justify it. All I can say is that I understand how and why it is. And part of it is the unfortunate experience of the galus, the exile, mm-hmm. that we've experienced for the last 2,000 years.
Well, she said that the Jewish community closed up.
Yes. Yes. It's a defense.
Yes, there are no open doors.
The fence.
Well, there are open doors. But
well, we have one now.
Yeah.
But it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
It's a matter of struggling to find some truths on your own, which my capabilities were not adequate to suit myself.
I spoke to some of my what I would consider some of the people who are my supporters in the synagogue, and I've broached the possibility of having some programming through the synagogue for non-Jews who are named Noah. Even with the idea of if you get the people in, they'll support the synagogue as well because they're deriving benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And they looked at me like,
crazy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all the emotional issues.
Yeah. Going
well,
to boy,
you're probably being assimilationist for the synagogue.
No, not that type of thinking. Why teach going in mind? That was the thinking.
And we get it from the other side too. I mean, it's why are you learning Jewish stuff if you're not converting?
That's why I'm giving you all these compliments. You're just that. You have to ignore their craziness and know that you're doing the right thing. And you're going on the path to God via truth. And that's it. Don't worry about the rest of it.
I'd like to respond one thing to Shirley. Everything you said was true. But what you said is also true to Jewish people, secular Jewish people. If they're not interested, you've shown an interest. If they're Jewish and they don't show any interest, they don't learn any more than the non-Jews.
There's a saying that Gerim are very difficult to the people of Israel, converts. They're like a sapachas, a kind of a disease. I'm sure you must have heard that. Right? And there's two reasons for that, two approaches. One of the approaches is...
I never heard that. That's Gerim.
Yeah.
Because Gerim stands above.
Well, but that's because if you have a convert who 3 weeks ago he was living as an idolater, and then he saw the truth of Torah, and he decided, you know what, I'm giving up this whole lifestyle. I now accept Torah and Mitzvot as my lifestyle.
Yeah.
And they pursue it, and they live according to that perception of truth. What does that make us native-born Jews look like if we're not living up to the standards? And now, not only that, you're a goy, a non-Jew, and you're doing these things too, and you're making me look
bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you think?
Because you can...
No, it's a metaphor.
If the Jewish community...
So that's part of what's occurring.
I understand.
And it is also a certain sense of guilt, a sense of jealousy as well.
On the Jews' part, you're saying?
On the Jews' part.
Yes, but they have to realize... If they're... Just one moment. If your platform was open to a few of us...
Yeah.
You would also find that we have a great sense of guilt.
But no one knows why
we want to do this, and there would be a heartfelt relief if someone would understand where we're coming from.
There's a certain sense of also fear. There's the concern, well, you guys must be studying this missionaries. You know, that's always a thing in people's minds. And I check people out initially. You know, some people are missionaries and some are not. But there's
another issue that, Sherry, I'm in the company of Jewish people, and there's non-Jewish people present. I've been told by some of the Jewish people they're afraid they may say something that's going to hurt the feelings of the non-Jewish person, so they sort of are uncomfortable.
I've had it happen. I've made some comments about different religions, and then someone told me about it. Months later, you know, I was really upset. I have no idea what I said. I remember having a conversation, and I kind of thought that he was positive in some of the things. I think the things I was talking about may have been related to anti-Semitism, and I don't remember yet. It's not easy to not insult people. Because, again, people have their frames of reference that are very holy.
Well, and there are a lot of different groups of people, too. I mean, you're talking about a Gentile who doesn't have any religious background, or you're talking about one who does, that's into Christianity, or you're talking about one who has escaped from that, you know. But, I mean, how do you know who you're talking to at a given time? And these are the only safe ways to do it, you know.
I wonder too if it's from the perspective of how we struggle because we're done, you know, we're thirsty for this knowledge and everything.
It's like, you've got it, why aren't you giving it to us?
Well, it's also like we look at our kids, maybe they won't have to struggle so hard, but then if that child, if you're in an environment where it's real easy and it's always available, maybe you don't appreciate it.
That's
much.
Somebody
who's
That's
interesting.
We don't appreciate.
I'm sorry, we assume what?
We go to Orthodox rabbis and then we make the assumption.